He's NPR's puzzle master, the editor of the New York Times crossword puzzle, and the only person in the world known to hold a college degree in enigmatology. Today, I'll talk with Will Shortz. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'll talk with puzzle master Will Shortz about his lifelong passion for puzzles. We'll find out how a crossword puzzle is created and edited. We'll also talk table tennis and, of course, take your calls. Then later in the hour, kids solving some of life's puzzles. I'll talk about Invent Iowa with Susan Asseline of the Bell and Blank Center at the University of Iowa and members of the Titan Hill Intermediate School Lego League of Council Bluffs. Join our conversation after the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. It's been 12 years since hijackers took over four planes and crashed them into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and a field in Pennsylvania. Memorial services are underway at each site. President Obama visited the Pentagon today to honor the families of the victims.
What the heart has once owned and had, it shall never lose. What your family's lost in the temporal, in the here and now, is now eternal. The pride that you carry in your hearts, the love that will never die.
In New York City, people have gathered to read the names of victims from the World Trade Center.
Terrence Edward Adderley Jr.
Sophia B. Otto.
In Shanksville, Pennsylvania, bells were rung and the names of passengers and crew members from hijacked Flight 93 were also read aloud. President Obama says he wants to give diplomacy a chance in Syria while keeping the use of military force as a fallback. NPR's Giles Snyder reports the president is conditionally endorsing a Russian plan to have Syria's chemical weapons seized and destroyed.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about solving puzzles. Later in the hour, we'll talk about kids who are solving real-life puzzles. But my first guest keeps puzzle solvers the world over busy with his puzzles. Will Shortz is the editor of the New York Times crossword puzzle and NPR's puzzle master. You, of course, can hear him every Sunday morning on Weekend Edition. And people in Iowa City can see him tonight at the Englert Theater in Iowa City. Hello, Will.
Good morning, Charity. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for coming into the studio today.
It's great to be here.
Well, let's go way back for you, because I know that your interest in puzzles started very early in life. When did you first start doing crossword puzzles?
Well, I started making puzzles when I was 8 or 9, and sold my first one when I was 14. You probably know I have the world's only college degree in puzzles from Indiana University. So I've always been a puzzle head.
When did you come up with the idea that you could possibly do this as a career?
Well, I remember in the 8th grade, when I was asked to write a paper on what I wanted to do with my life, I did it on becoming a professional puzzle maker. And it's just the craziest thing. What sort of 8th grader wants a career in puzzles? But that was my dream.
It was your calling.
Yeah.
Yes. And you did get your college degree in enigmatology. How did you make that happen? Because it wasn't offered as coursework.
That's
right?
Not a standard major.
No.
Indiana is one of the few colleges in the country where you can make up your major anything you want if you're admitted to the program. They have something called the Individualized Major Program. And I was applied, was accepted. There were no puzzle courses, of course. I made them all up myself. I'd find professors willing to work with me one-on-one on the subjects that I wanted to study. So, for example, one of them was crossword construction. And every few weeks, I'd make an original puzzle, original crossword. Those are the first real crosswords I made. Take them into my professor's office, sit next to him as he solved it and critiqued it. And I studied the history of puzzles, word puzzles. I made math puzzles, logic puzzles, studied the psychology of puzzles, which was partly how the brain works when we're solving a problem, and also why do we feel so compelled to solve puzzles. My thesis was on the history of American word puzzles before 1860.
Did you apprentice yourself to other puzzle makers?
Well, apprentice myself, no. But as I said, I started making puzzles I sold my first one when I was 14, became a regular contributor to Dell Puzzle Magazines when I was 16. And that's how you get good at puzzles, you know, you make them. I remember when I sent my first puzzle to the Dell magazines, they used to have this policy that you would have to submit two letters of recommendation on as to your personal character to show, I guess, that you weren't stealing your work. So here I was, a 16-year-old kid. I had this crazy fear that I would be taken advantage of because of my age. So I had my high school speech teacher write one of the letters and our family grocer. And in each case, I told them, don't let them know that I'm only 16.
As you went through college, you did get this degree. Did anyone try to dissuade you? Say, well, you know, you're good at this. Obviously, it's something you love, but this is not practical.
My parents told me that all the time, especially my dad. My dad was a personnel director for Donnelly Printing Company, and he always said, puzzles are a great avocation. They're not a vocation. And after I got my degree from Indiana, I went to law school at the University of Virginia.
So you listened to that message.
Well, I didn't think I could have a career in puzzles. I didn't think it was possible to do. And when I was in 1966, I wrote the Dmitri Borgman, who wrote this book, Language on Vacation. And it is the seminal book on wordplay. And I wrote him saying that I wanted a career in puzzles. What did he think? And he wrote a great three-page letter, single-spaced, typed, saying basically, don't do it. But he listed all the ways that you could have a career in puzzles, and he explained why none of them would work out. So my idea was that I would practice law for 10 years, make enough money to retire to do what I really wanted. But in the summer between Indiana and Virginia, I had an internship with a crossword magazine company, Penny Press. They're one of the ones that's still around today. They were in Connecticut. And I came back from the summer and realized this is how I could have a career, you know, with a regular job, not from making puzzles, but from editing them.
Okay. And how did you make your way to the New York Times?
So I was at Penny Press just for 7 months. Then I went to Games Magazine, where I was an editor and eventually the editor for 15 years. And then in 1993, the crossword editor at the Times died, Eugene T. Maleska, and I applied for the job. It's not really a job that I had ever lusted after, because I was, you know, at Games Magazine, they do all kinds of puzzles. I love, I don't want to be pigeonholed just in crosswords. I like any kind of puzzle. But it's the most prestigious job in puzzles, and I thought it would be fun. So I applied and got the job.
Wow.
So October will be my 20th anniversary at the Times.
And doing other kinds of puzzles, though, is something that you've never stopped doing. Obviously, we hear you every Sunday morning on Weekend Edition with other kinds of word puzzles, and you participate in tournaments and all kinds of different kinds of things. How much time do you spend outside of your work at the New York Times doing puzzles?
I'd say I spend a considerable amount of time outside the Times. And the great, first of all, the Times job is good for me because I think I brought a more of a wordplay and playful sense to the crossword than it had ever been there before. And outside of that, you know, I do my puzzles on NPR, which are, you know, original puzzles. I direct the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament. I founded and attend every year the World Puzzle Championship. Really, in July, I attended the International Puzzle Party in Japan for people who invent and collect mechanical puzzles. So, as I say, I'm crazy about puzzles.
Well, and you've become something of a celebrity as well because of your puzzle work. And we have a clip from an appearance that you did, I think it was in 2011, on a sitcom called How I Met Your Mother, where you were the dream guest of the main character, Ted, at his dream party with all of these elite intellectuals. And here's just a moment of Ted telling his friends why he's so excited.
Guys, Will Shortz, editor of the Times Crossword. You know how I've been saying they always use Yuli from Yuli's Gold because of the vowels? Well, tell them, Will, tell them.
Because of the vowels?
It's because of the vowels!
Oh, wow.
Ted, can I talk to you just for a second?
Hey, Will, 10-letter word for diminutive egg-based tort.
Mini quiche? Where?
Right there.
So that was an appearance on How I Met Your Mother. You've been on The Simpsons. You've been on The Daily Show. You've been on The Colbert Report. And everybody knows your name. Did you ever think that being a puzzle creator would also bring with it this celebrity?
No, I would never imagine that. And it's so crazy because puzzles are a solitary activity, number one. And second, most people don't know what I look like because when my puzzles appear in the newspaper, there's no face there. There's no face to me on the radio. But people know me from Wordplay, the movie about crosswords and me and my crossword championship or other ways.
When you get asked to do something like How I Met Your Mother, what goes through your mind?
Well, that came about because a number of people on the show and the writers and the people who started the show love puzzles, love crosswords. And they had this episode where they had a snooty Manhattan party, and they were thinking what sorts of guests should be at this snooty party. Somehow they thought of me.
Do you go to a lot of snooty parties?
I do not go to that. Don't go to snooty parties, no.
With Arianna Huffington.
Yeah.
Let's talk about how you create the puzzles. Or I know that you are a puzzle editor, but how the puzzles come into creation at the New York Times. You get a lot of submissions from other people, right?
Right. I get 75 to 100 submissions a week. Every puzzle needs to be looked at and replied to, yes or no. And I try to give the contributor a few extra words about what I liked or didn't like about the puzzle. Once I accept a puzzle, and only about 10% of the submissions get accepted because I can publish only 7 a week. You know, I slot it for a particular day of the week, and then I have an inventory anywhere from several months to maybe a year, depending on the day of the week that the puzzle's slated for. And then I'll edit, typeset the puzzles, go to the testers. That's part of what goes into the job.
How much input do you have on each puzzle? You edit it, you make sure that it's right, but also how much do you change and how much is Will Shortz?
I'm a real hands-on editor. First of all, I think my biggest influence in the puzzle is simply what the puzzles I accept, the ideas that excite me. And I like fresh, funny, interesting ideas that twist your brain, things that have never been done before. And when it comes to editing a puzzle, I'm a very hands-on editor. On average, about half the clues are mine. And I'm editing for accuracy, level of difficulty, freshness, everything that I think will make the puzzle the best possible experience for you that I can make it.
How do you decide on level of difficulty?
Well, I'm a puzzle doer myself, so I just put myself in the shoes of a solver, thinking, first of all, a Monday puzzle is the easiest of the week, and that's going to have mostly familiar vocabulary, maybe entirely familiar things, stuff that you know. And I'll try to write the clues as easy as I can, while still having some fresh twists in there once in a while. And a Tuesday, Wednesday puzzle will be a little more playful, maybe a little wordplay. Thursday is usually the tricky day of the week. Friday and Saturday typically are themeless puzzles. No theme, but just wide open spaces, lots of white squares, lots of fresh vocabulary that you've never seen before.
How long does it take you to assess a puzzle when you get it in your hands and you look at it as far as difficulty? How quickly do you know, is this hard or is this easy?
Well, first I look for quality. And a bad puzzle I can see in 5 seconds. A really good puzzle, I can make that determination in a minute. The puzzles that take the longest to think about are the ones in between. Think, yeah, I like this, but I don't really like that. Is this worth salvaging? How much do I like this? And that can take a long time.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Will Shortz, NPR's puzzle master and the editor of the New York Times crossword puzzle. He is appearing this evening at the Englert Theater in Iowa City at 7 o'clock. And last time I checked, there were still a few tickets available for that appearance tonight. You are welcome to join our conversation as well with your questions for Will Shortz, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about solving puzzles. And my guest right now is Will Shortz, the editor of the New York Times Crossword Puzzle and NPR's Puzzle Master. And again, he's appearing this evening at the Englert Theater in Iowa City at 7 o'clock. And Will, we were talking earlier about when you wanted to have a career as someone who made puzzles, and you reached out to find out if that would even be possible. Do people send you those letters now and say, hey, Will, I want to make puzzles for a living. How can I make that happen?
If you want a career in puzzles, the thing to do is just start making puzzles, whatever kind you like. The traditional way is to make crosswords, send them to a publication. Nowadays, there are other avenues. There are a lot of puzzle apps now. And I guess the way to get started there is have a good app, make a great puzzle, offer it for free, get people hooked, and then find a way to start
upgrade somehow.
Upgrade,
right?
Charge money if they want more of them.
How has this generation of people who have instant information all the time, how do you think that is changing crossword puzzles? Because we don't sit and ponder big ideas for very long. We just look them up on our smartphones.
And that's why I think crosswords, even though they're a traditional kind of puzzle, it's almost like they are ideally designed for the modern age. Because think about it, you're solving a daily crossword. On average, there are about 76 clues and answers. Each one you spend a couple of seconds on. That's sort of like the modern age. Our minds jump from one subject to another. We don't spend a lot of time on any one subject, typically. And they're just perfect for the modern age.
But it's tempting when you get stuck to reach for that smartphone.
And why not? I have no problem. One of my predecessors at the New York Times, Will Wing, used to say, it's your puzzle, solve it any way you like.
What kinds of resources do you use when you solve a puzzle?
When I solve a puzzle, well, I won't use resources.
My
resource is my brain.
So it is cheating.
But when I'm editing a puzzle, first of all, I am surrounded by books. I counted once, I think I have 60 feet of shelf space of reference books. And of course, nowadays I spend a lot of time online checking facts and looking things up, trying to find interesting information about words.
All right. You are welcome to join our conversation. I'm talking with Puzzle Master Will Shortz. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Jim is on the line in Spencer. Hi, Jim.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I just, I first met Will with Games Magazine, and one of the most memorable puzzles on there, I love the magazine, but I was fascinated by the one they created where they drove across country and they took these photographs at different points along the way, and then you were supposed to figure out which photograph was taken from, which vantage point facing whichever way. And just loved it and thought, hey, there's a great puzzle that could be altered for, possibly the Sunday show. There's, State of Iowa has a lot of really amazing names for their communities. I thought, let's make a puzzle where you drive across Iowa and when you get to the other side, you have a complete sentence.
Okay. I'll have to think about that.
Right. Or you'll have to make that one up. Jim, did you have a question?
Well, I just thought there was a way that a person could submit to Will's, just catalog of puzzles that they use on the Sunday show, and wondered how you go about that.
I do take proposals or suggestions for my challenge puzzles, the ones at the end of the segment, and anyone can send one in to NPR, and it gets routed to me. The on-air puzzles are always my own work.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot for your call. Karen is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Karen.
Hello. I'm honored to speak with you. I listen every Sunday to the puzzle, and my husband is a subscriber to the New York Times crossword puzzle.
Excellent.
And so there's your way to make money. we always, he goes, the clue, the answer is always Lodi, and then it's either California or New Jersey.
I know that city, there's two prominent Lodis.
There you are. Well, there's a third one that my husband and I grew up in, a small town in Wisconsin, home of Susie the Duck, and we would be honored if you would use home of Susie the Duck as a clue, and the answer is Lodi.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind. I think I would be strung up. by a lot of solvers if I did that little Wisconsin town.
Well, you string them up and foil Plotum and Saramian or whoever those people are that are always at the top of the puzzle solvers list.
All right. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Karen.
Right, Karen. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot for your call. And we hear on the show on Weekend Edition, you often mention playing table tennis as well, and that's something else you devote a lot of time to. And you're actually going to be playing table tennis today in Iowa.
I am, twice. This afternoon I'm driving to Davenport to play with the Quad Cities Table Tennis Club. And after my presentation tonight, I'm playing at the University of Iowa Table Tennis Club.
Now, you started doing puzzles when you were very young. When did table tennis start for you?
Also very young, my family had a ping pong table in our recreation room. So I played as a kid, won some trophies when I was in high school. In 2001, I joined a club near where I live in New York. And I've just got more and more obsessed with it. So I now own my own table tennis club in my hometown of Pleasantville. It's the largest table tennis facility in the country. And I play every day. I'm on a mission, actually, to play table tennis every day this year. Yesterday was the 253rd day of the year. I have not missed yet, and I'm filming myself every day. Going to have to do a video at the end of the year showing me play table tennis every day.
What is the most challenging part of trying to play table tennis every day?
Traveling, for example. Next month, I'm flying to Beijing for the World Puzzle Championship. My plane leaves at 9:30 in the morning. I don't get to China until the next day. So in order to get that day, a friend is meeting me. We're meeting at my club at 6 a.m. We'll play for a half hour, go to the plane together, go to Beijing, and we have friends there meeting us at the airport at like 5:30 in the afternoon and take us directly to a club in Beijing. So I will get every day.
What do you see as the relationship between table tennis and puzzle solving?
A couple of things. First of all, they're both brain games. With table tennis, you have to train your body to instinctively react to certain shots and to perform well. And during a match, you're analyzing your opponent's game to his weaknesses and trying to exploit those and also play to your own strengths. But I tell you, I play table tennis for the same reason most people do crosswords. It's something completely different from my everyday life. I get completely focused on it, block out the rest of the world, and when I'm done, I feel relaxed and refreshed and ready to go back to everything else in life.
All right. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Let's go back to the phones. Rick is on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Rick.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
First of all, welcome to Will. And I don't really have a question. I just have a big thank you. I'm sure you don't even remember this with the thousands of puzzles you've done over the years. But my first wife, passed away in 2004. She was a huge crossword fan, and she and a bunch of her friends every Sunday morning would get together and do the New York Times puzzle. And my daughters got into that, too. And one of them is just a crossword fanatic. And after my wife died, my daughter wrote you a letter and sent you information on my wife's life and history and interesting quirks. And she was a piano teacher and touched a lot of kids. And you were kind enough to create a custom puzzle with a bunch of her clues hidden in it. And it was published. And we got that one matted and framed. So thank you very much.
Oh, that's so nice.
That's
thanks
wonderful,
for letting
Rick.
Me know.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. You must get a lot of requests. I mean, that's obviously a very special request that Rick was talking about, but people must reach out to you quite a lot.
The one that I most remember was in 1997. There was a young lawyer in Manhattan said he wanted to propose to his girlfriend through the Times crossword because she was a big crossword doer. And so I assigned the idea to a colleague of mine who made the puzzle. And it contained the proposal in the puzzle, although it didn't. It was a general enough puzzle that anyone could enjoy it and didn't realize there was a message specifically for her. But if you read between the lines, as she did, there was that proposal. And they got married. They've been married now for 15 years. They send me a little present every January on their anniversary.
Oh, that's so cool. What was the message? Do you remember?
Sure. There were three theme answers. They were... Uh, the 1726 Jonathan Swift pamphlet, which was A Modest Proposal. And across the middle of the diagram was Gary Lewis and the Playboys hit, This Diamond Ring. And across the bottom was the Paula Abdul hit, Will You Marry Me? And there was also the answer yes in the puzzle, which was Clouda's hoped-for answer to. So, she did the puzzle. She said yes. And they invited the puzzle maker and me to their wedding.
And how did she know it was the message for her?
Well, two answers to that. First of all, her name and his name were both in the puzzle, although not clued with them. His name was Bill, and so it was clued in terms of Bill Gates, and hers was Emily, so it was clued in terms of Dickinson. But there were all these clues that looked like it was for her. Actually, she wasn't sure. And they were having brunch together. She thought the puzzle was for her, but how could it be? This was the crossword that everyone was doing that day in the Times. And she was afraid to say anything in case it was all a coincidence.
Right.
And she looks at him and says, this puzzle. And he asked, will you marry me?
Oh, wow.
And she said yes.
Oh, what a great story. Let's go back to the phones. Jay is on the line in Ames. Hello, Jay.
Hello, Charity. Will.
Oh.
Fraternity Pi Kappa Alpha.
And you know what, Jay, I'm going to have you start again. We cut you off there for just a second. Can you start over?
Cut off a few times. Okay. Yeah, Will is one of our famous alums from our fraternity, Pi Kappa Alpha.
Right.
And my question for Will has he been contacted by the researchers? There's been a lot of talk lately about puzzles and video games used to keep older minds active to offset dementia and Alzheimer's and things like that. And since I'm 54... I kind of want to know what things are going to be best for me as I get older, since you can't do all the puzzles all the time.
Well, why not? Why can't you do all puzzles all the time?
Because I haven't retired yet. It's not my full-time job like you.
There you go. Well, actually, the research is controversial. Not all the researchers agree. But I am convinced that puzzle solving helps prevent dementia and Alzheimer's disease. It will... is just like the brain is like any other muscle. If you use it, you're going to keep it active and limber. And puzzle solving, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that puzzle solving is good for the brain. And I believe that too.
What kinds of people do you think are drawn to puzzles?
Well, the survey showed that about 17% of Americans solve crosswords, and many people do other kinds. So it's obviously not just one type. But to be a good puzzle solver, first of all, you have to have patience. It's the sort of person who has a flexible mind. That's the most important thing, to be able to think of many different ways that a problem can be solved and figure out the correct path to solve this particular puzzle. I think as puzzle solving gives you a feeling of being in control of life, from solving a mystery. Yeah, I think puzzle people like mysteries. And when you solve a difficult puzzle, you take that process through from start to finish. That's not something we do much in life. You know, you're just thrown into the middle of things and you muddle through and move on to the next thing. With a crossword or a Sudoku or any kind of human-made puzzle, you see the process through from start to finish. And when you're done, you feel you've mastered something. You feel you're king of the hill. You feel great, and it's a feeling you want to have as much as possible.
And talking about 17% of the population doing crossword puzzles, do you know how many, what percentage actually finishes crossword puzzles?
Well, it depends, of course, on the day of the week as far as the crossword goes. Monday in the New York Times is the easiest, and if you've never tried a crossword before, I'd say pick up a Monday New York Times crossword. It's lively, it's got substance to it, but it's also pretty easy. And if you can do it and you like it, you know, move on and see how far through the week you can go. The puzzles get very hard by Friday and Saturday. Sunday is a larger puzzle, but it's only about Thursday level of difficulty.
We've talked about how our instant technology may have changed how people solve puzzles. Has all of our technology created new ways for you to create puzzles?
There are computer programs now for crossword construction. You could, if you wanted to make a bad crossword, just take one of these programs. And I'm told that it can create an entire crossword magazine, all the puzzles, and lay out all the clues on the pages in 3 seconds. But those aren't going to be good crosswords. It takes a human mind to make a good puzzle. First of all, most crosswords have themes. It takes a human to think of that. It takes a human to get the best vocabulary in the puzzle. And a human can add things to the database that from everyday life that aren't in any dictionary but makes good crossword answers. And then, of course, it takes a human mind to write an original clue. So when you're solving a good crossword, you're matching wits with another person, not a machine.
We have time for just one more call here. Tim is on the line from Green. Hi, Tim. Oh, nope, we don't have time for that call because the phone line is in use at the moment. So I'm sorry about dropping that call on you. Well, what do you think the future of puzzles is? We do see these trends come and go. Sudoku wasn't something that we heard much about, let's say, 20 years ago when started doing the New York Times.
It was a craze in 2005 and 6, yeah.
So what do you think the future looks like?
Well, if I knew what the future was like, I could get very rich. I don't know. It's impossible to predict puzzle fads and crazes. They just spring up and you know, if Sudoku had come along 3 years later, it might not have been a craze. It just hit at the right time.
Is there anything new that you've seen that's kind of exciting to you?
Well, the trend in crosswords is to have the answer words be as familiar as possible, all familiar answers. There's almost nothing in a good crossword nowadays that you don't know. The clues can be tricky and hard and twist your brain, but the answers you know. And that's different from the old days when there was a lot of obscurity.
So does that make it more accessible to the public? Is that the goal?
Yes, it makes it more accessible, makes it more fun. Crosswords now have a broader audience than ever before. In the old days, crosswords, you know, they had a reputation for being for old folks and only older folks. Nowadays, they're for everybody. I've published 29 teenagers in the last 20 years and lots of 20-somethings. And the whole history of the Times crossword up to me, there are only 5 teens known to have been published. So, and if you look at the puzzles nowadays, they embrace everybody's culture. They're still going to have the old stuff, but it's going to have new things as well. I want everybody to see part of their life in the crossword.
Will Shortz, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Charity.
What a pleasure. Will Shortz, NPR's puzzle master, of course. He's also the editor of the New York Times crossword puzzle. He will be appearing tonight in Iowa City at the Englert Theater at 7 p.m. Coming up in just a few minutes, we will talk about puzzles of a different kind. We're going to talk about kids solving real-life puzzles through a program called Invent Iowa. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We've been talking about puzzles this hour, and now we're going to move on to real-life puzzles and kids solving real-life puzzles. We're going to talk about a program called Invent Iowa, which gives kids all over the state an opportunity to solve some real-life problems. And coming up in a few minutes, we'll also talk about a Lego league in Council Bluffs that has invented a wheelchair that can convert into a walker and back again. With me in the studio now is Susan Asseline of the Bell and Blank Center at the University of Iowa. Hello, Susan.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today. And first, what is Invent Iowa?
Well, thank you for inviting me to be here today. Invent Iowa is one of the programs of the Bell and Blank Center. We're a comprehensive center for gifted and talented education. And by comprehensive, I mean that we offer programming for students, for teachers. We have a clinic, et cetera. But our Invent Iowa program is pretty unique because it is really something that taps into the inventiveness process. And I think we're the only center for gifted education that has an invention program.
When did this start?
It started actually before the center started in the late 1980s, and it has been a part of the center since our inception.
How does it work?
Well, it works by having students find a problem and something that they're interested in solving. And that could be building a better mousetrap, or it could be finding a mitten dryer, or it could be helping a relative who has a disability. And we actually have seen some many inventions that have focused on trying to help friends or relatives who have problems. And that's really special when we see that.
And how do kids get involved? Is this through talented and gifted groups, or can it be any kind of a group?
Well, you don't need to be identified as being as needing talented and gifted programming, but many times it is actually through our highly capable, talented and gifted teachers in the state of Iowa who actually bring this to the school and make these opportunities available to students.
So it's an opportunity for them to get involved. And if it's an Does it have to be a group, or can it be an individual child?
It can be an individual child. The best thing to do, actually, is to go to the Bell and Blank Center website and to take a look at that website under students and the programs that we offer for students in the year-long programs. And then you can see how to get started with the Invent Iowa process. And I really just want to pick up on Will Short's word there, process, because the Invent Iowa program is all about the process, beginning with finding a problem, something that you want to solve, and then carrying that all the way through till you have actually solved that problem. And I think that's the part that's really cool about that. And it doesn't rely on having been identified for any particular program.
I want to bring some more guests into the conversation now. Cheryl Ryan is a fifth grade teacher and the Lego League coach at Titan Hill Intermediate School in Council Bluffs. Hello, Cheryl.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome. We're excited to be here.
And you also have with you two eighth graders, Hannah Dunlop and Anna Ford, and they are eighth graders at Lewis Central Middle School. And
correct.
Can they hear me as well, or just you right now?
I think they can hear us.
All right. Hello, Anna and Hannah.
Hello.
And Cheryl, can you give me a little bit of background on this group and on the project you've been working on, which is an invention of a wheelchair that can convert into a walker and back again?
Yes. They are participants in a Lego League team, and each year Lego League has a different challenge for the teams to solve, and these are teams around the world. Last year, the Senior Solutions Challenge was issued, and basically every team had to create an invention that either helped seniors get around, stay fit, or keep in touch. We thought, hey, this sounded like a very easy invention. Hey, we can do this. And then we quickly realized seniors have almost everything they could possibly want. So it actually proved to be a very difficult challenge, trying to find something that the girls could create that would be very worthwhile to seniors. And that was the hard piece, was that worthwhile piece.
Well, and let me talk to Hannah for a moment. Hannah, where did this idea come from? Where did you guys get the idea for this wheelchair, convertible wheelchair?
Well, we started with the main topics, which were getting around, and that was the one that we wanted to go with. And one of our team members had a great uncle that always liked to go to basketball games, but in order to do that, he had to always have someone with him with his wheelchair. And we thought that was a problem because he never got to go because someone didn't always get to go with him. And so we thought of the idea, why not combining them?
All right. And how did you start to work on that problem?
We went through patent research and looked what kind of wheelchair walkers there were. And we found out that there was a lot of things that had small wheels that were all four. And we wanted, and that would lose independence for the person.
Because they would have to be pushed instead of being able to push themselves, right?
Right. And that's where we went with, we should use big wheels instead, and they could go by themselves.
All right. Well, why don't you pass the phone to Anna, and we'll get her part of the story as well. Anna, when you guys came up with the idea that you wanted to have big wheels on a convertible wheelchair that could be converted into a walker, did you start trying out wheelchairs to see how you could make it work? Oh, is Anna there?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah. We kind of partnered with a local company called Mobilis, and they help with was medical equipment for like wheelchairs and walkers and stuff. And so they helped us a lot. Like, we got to see all of the different wheelchairs that they had, with like the big propulsion wheels or the little wheels. And so, yeah, we got to try out a couple and see what worked best.
Can you describe for me how the wheelchair that you created works?
Basically, it's a wheelchair that converts into a walker in very few easy steps. The seat flips up and attaches to the back with Velcro, and then there's a stabilizing kick bar that, when it's in the wheelchair, it'll keep it so that the wheelchair doesn't collapse, and so... But when you walk, you can kick it back and you can walk with it. But that kick bar, because we had a cross brace that is under the seat, it would be in the way when it was a walker. And so we had to move it to the back of the wheelchair, which caused all the stability problems. So we had to install that kick bar. And so, yeah, and then when it's in the walker, you basically walk like you're facing the back of the wheelchair, and so it's very easy to get around in.
And did you actually have people who need wheelchairs and walkers try this out?
Yeah, we actually went to a local senior citizen home and had a couple of people try it out, and they gave us a lot of feedback, which helped us modify it so that everyone could use it.
All right. Well, can you pass me back to Cheryl again, the Lego League coach in Council Bluffs? And Cheryl, I know that this invention placed first runner-up in the regional first Lego League competition, and then it got entered into Invent Iowa, which we're talking about right now, and it won first place. So what's next for the girls and for this wheelchair?
They have not stopped. Winning and getting a scholarship to either come to Iowa or Iowa State was just like the highlight for the girls. But we had somebody call and say that they needed our invention because it got a lot of publicity in the newspaper. And I told her I didn't have one for her. And she literally cried and said, "Well, you were my last hope. Now I have to go to a nursing home." And that really struck with the girls, and they said, "We cannot stop. We have to make this available for people like her." And so they decided to go ahead and seek a patent. They have their provisional already, and they're working on the full licensed patent. They have until March to get it finished. So they're actually going to take a year off from Lego League so that they can devote their time to making sure they get this done and into production.
Wow, that's so exciting. Cheryl, thank you so much for talking with me today. And please say thank you to Hannah and Anna for me as well. And congratulations to the entire team. Cheryl Ryan is a fifth grade teacher and the Lego League coach at Titan Hill Intermediate School in Council Bluffs. Hannah Dunlop and Anna Ford are both eighth graders at Lewis Central Middle School in Council Bluffs. And Susan Asseline, I want to come back to you. This is an example of an invention that won Invent Iowa. It may very well go into production and be something that affects a lot of people's lives. Have you seen that happen over the years with Invent Iowa?
We have, and let me just step back for a minute and congratulate this team. And by team, I mean not just the students. It's awesome what they did. It's very, very impressive. But what you see is what happens when you have a teacher who's supportive and a teacher who really wants to help them through the process and is ready to stand back and say, "Here's what you can do," and then also step in when they might need some guidance. So congratulations to them. That's really fantastic. You've just demonstrated something that, you know, we try very hard to make sure that people understand. This is something that, you know, we don't at the Bell and Blank Center say you should submit this for patent, but we really encourage that. And we have some information on our website. And there are many lawyers who are very interested in helping young folks move forward in terms of getting their inventions patented. And this just really was a crystallizing example of the students who are interested in helping individuals with a disability. They're interested in helping people better their lives, and they're not going to stop. I mean, they're in fifth grade.
Eighth grade.
Yeah, still, but it's the teacher who's a fifth grade.
Right.
That's right. So, but they're eighth grade. That's just fantastic. Think of what they're going to be able to do. And I hope that they will consider coming to the University of Iowa, not just as regular university students, but actually take advantage of the many summer program opportunities that exist. Certainly on our campus, I would be remiss in not supporting the programs on our campus, but all over the country, there are many programs, and these opportunities are also crystallizing opportunities for students.
Can you give me a few other examples of some of the winning inventions over the years?
Well, I will give you another one that is also related to disability. There's a young man who had a physical disability. It was very difficult for him to walk, and indeed he had to use a wheelchair, but he was an avid hunter. And so he developed a couple of inventions that were related to helping him hunt more effectively, and the blinds that you use so to set up a hunting site. It was very interesting, and we loved having him come to the invention convention, the annual invention convention that we host, and also the students who are part of the annual invention convention are recognized annually at our recognition ceremony as well. And he attended that. I've lost track. I don't know what has happened to him in the early years when he was doing this. But I do know he was featured on the cover of one of the hunting magazines for his invention.
Oh, fascinating. You know, you mentioned how someone's disability is something that inspires a lot of kids to try to come up with solutions. What are some of the other common things that inspire students to come up with inventions?
Well, I'm going to talk about two other things. I think I have time. Several years ago, we had a governor who's also governor now, but he had a sledding accident. I don't know if you...
I remember that well. He had his jaw wired shut.
Yes. And there were many inventions for the next couple of years that related to having a better, safer sled. So safety was really, really important.
Kids were very concerned about the governor.
Very
and his
concerned
broken
about
jaw.
That. Right. Okay. And just safety, which was really interesting. Another invention that I think of every winter when I'm shoveling and using my snowblower is the invention that was developed by two young men that actually took a mower and added a broom to a mower so that when the snow was light, because the snowblower doesn't actually work when the snow is too light, but this was to motorize a broom and take advantage of the motor from a lawnmower. And I think of that all the time. I don't know what happened with that particular invention. I will admit I don't do very much shoveling.
But every time you do, you think, boy, I wish I had
well,
that.
And every time I see a light dusting, I think of that.
Absolutely.
So those are two that come to my mind just immediately and that I think of often.
Approximately how many kids get involved in Invent Iowa every year?
That's a hard number to estimate. We estimate several thousand because there are students out there who we don't know about right now who are actually engaged in the process. And then by the time it gets they submit their invention in any time between now and February. And there's a first round of taking a look at this. And that's usually a couple of hundred. About 300 inventions are submitted. And then the top 10% for each grade level is recognized at our state invention convention. And that's how then the students, like these two young women, who received the first place.
All right. Wonderful. Susan Asseline, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Susan Asseline of the Bell and Blank Center at the University of Iowa. We've been talking about Invent Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Ben Stanton, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can send email anytime to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Coming up today at noon, it's River to River, and with me now, the host of River to River, Ben Kiefer. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Charity. This afternoon at noon, we're going to examine how the president took his case for military action in Syria to the American public last night and ask our listeners, were you convinced when the president said our ideals and principles as well as our national security are at stake? Our analysts today, Bruce Gronbeck of the University of Iowa and Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University. A lot of other questions there, too, surrounding the Syrian crisis, which has been consuming the political oxygen
right.
in the air for a couple
weeks
there's now.
There's so much to talk about with Syria. Are there any other topics on the docket, or is it?
Well, of course, we're going to be thinking, looking back, as this is the anniversary of 9/11, how our politics have changed since 9/11. Do we feel more secure, for instance? A lot to talk about. We hope that our listeners will join in with their questions, with their concerns and observations, Charity.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ben. That's coming up at noon on River to River here on Iowa Public Radio. Our theme music for Talk of Iowa was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, Grandmothers of the 21st Century. We'll talk about how being a grandmother has changed over the generations and how many grandmas are approaching their role today. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.